You are listening to a show that was originally broadcast on March 5th, 2017. All mention of events in the show are from that time, 2017.
You are listening to Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington. Welcome to Forest Halls Celtic. I'm your host, Jane Valencia, and we have an hour of mostly Celtic music with forays into neighboring genres coming for you today from 12 to 1 p.m. We also have a special guest today, storyteller Allison Cox from here from the island is going to tell us a story, and we'll get to chat with her a bit. This episode is devoted to the theme of living and dying. We are going to explore the grief, longing, and beauty as we go on our musical journey, and we'll slip past the veil and enter the other world. This is part of the Vashon conversation with the living, officially Vashon Conversation for the Living About Dying project, which has been happening all weekend, starting on Thursday. And there have been a series of events where we have been exploring this whole question because, you know, we're all headed in that direction. So we're going to start out with a little bit of music. These are a set of Scottish pieces. The first one is a lament. Actually, the second one is as well. This one is Dark Haired Alan, sung by Karen Matheson. And you may be familiar with the song. It was in Rob Roy. And it was actually composed in the, I think in the early 1700s. There was a young woman who was going to marry a sea captain, Alan Morrison, and Annie Campbell was awaiting him. He was coming in on a ship, and there was a terrible storm, and all hands were lost. And she did not end up marrying him, and she ended up being just so grief-laden. She came up with this beautiful song, and she ended up wasting away and dying of grief. Very sad. So, Dark Alan, followed by Neil Gow's lament of the death of his second wife.
Could I miss a half wish Mochsvatin yes me kedi oh he
Thank you. My soul longs to be free, Jean, and angels wait on me. Tay the land, oh, the mule. So fare thee weel, my angel. This world's care is vain, Jean. We'll meet and I be fain. Tay the land. Wadging like snarreaths and fodging, I'm wearing wad. Tay the land of the lil. There's nae sorrow there, Jean. There's neither cold nor care, Jean. The day is aye fair. In the land of the lil.
Andy M. Stewart, and he is in the land of the Leal, I'm sorry to say. Let's see, we had Alistair Fraser and Paul Macklis before that with Neil Gow's Lament of the Death of His Second Wife. And we opened the set with Karen Matheson with Dark Allen. You are listening to Forest Halls Celtic on KVSH 101.9 FM, also live streaming on voiceofvashon.org. And you can hear the show on demand, the latest episode, at voiceofvashon.org, and go to the shows and host tab, click on Forest Halls Celtic and find it there.
The show you're listening to today is a rebroadcast of one that aired originally on March of 2017. So all events that you hear mentioned took place back then.
All right. Well, we have with us, as I mentioned, Allison Cox. Welcome to Forest Halls Celtic.
Thank you.
Yeah, Allison is a wonderful storyteller. She and I told stories on Friday at the Sugar Shack as part of the Vashon Conversation for the Living About Dying. And we presented a lot of stories about death. And Allison, I have to ask you now, I've never heard this story, but have you been telling stories all your life? Like, even as a child, did you tell stories?
Well, I came from a family that told stories. My father used to say that the first liar didn't have a chance because everyone would say, oh, no, you told it wrong. And then they'd build on it and, the fish would get bigger. So, yeah, I think that it just is kind of in my blood.
And then how did you end up starting to tell perform stories?
Well, you know, I came at it from a different angle than a lot of the other tellers that I meet because I was studying psychology. And at the time, I was starting to get training in hypnotherapy. And during the hypnotherapy training, one of the components of that was talking about therapeutic metaphor. And it seemed to me, I mean, obviously there was more to it, but it seemed to me they were mostly telling stories. One day I had on my desk open a book that talked about patterns of storytelling and a hypnotherapy book that talked about patterns of induction. And I noticed that some of the language patterns that were described on each of those pages were identical. And I decided that maybe what I wanted to really do was to become a storyteller because people didn't expect that when I would tell stories to them that I would cure everything or make them dance like a chicken. And besides which, I just really grew to love it.
Yeah. So when did you... Oh, and I have to ask this as a performer. Did you find it came naturally to be able to go in front of people and tell a story, or was it something that you had to cultivate in yourself?
Yes to both. Because, my mother was a speech and drama major, and so I think I was groomed a bit in how to speak, and also the fact that I was surrounded by all these people that would gather every weekend to be together, my family, and tell each other their tales. Usually that was real, true life stories. But also I remember one of the first times that I auditioned, my knees shook so bad And of course, I decided for some bizarre reason to wear knickers, so it was more obvious than normal. But yeah, it took a while for me to not be self-conscious about it. And since I came to it from hypnotherapy, you know, at first I would like be so into the story that I could imagine the people's faces in the audience turning into the animals in the story, things like that. So it's good to pull out a little and be responsive to the expressions and the nuances and have that be a live event in reaction to my audience as well.
Oh, yeah. 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 I hear what you say. I think when I started telling stories too, I had this, I was very conscious about looking around the room or the forest is where I was telling stories mostly with the kids, and imagining the place right there, physically right there, and placing myself in it. And yeah, interesting to do that. So tell me, where do you collect your stories from? How does the story choose you, or you choose the story?
Oh my gosh, you know, it's kind of like, because I'm a storyteller, there's always that part of me that's got that little radar out there for something. I told a story Friday night about the elephants of Tula Tula. I originally found that on Facebook, of all places, and then followed that trail to do research. There's other stories, like the one that I brought today, where I went looking for storytellers, and I interviewed a storyteller. This particular one that I wanted to tell, I had written a series of two books called The Healing Heart Books, Healing Heart Family and Healing Heart Communities, which is about how we take stories and use them with everything from mothers trying to bond with their babies and feel like they're good at what they're doing for the first time, all the way to working with elders who are starting to lose their memory, and have stories as a way to kind of help refresh them and pull some of those memories back out that they can enjoy, and everything in between. Working in schools, I had worked for the health department as a social worker, but I also had storyteller on my card too, because that was how I did my work. So I was invited to a conference on healing story, an international conference in Sweden. And after I left there, I used that opportunity while I was in Europe to interview storytellers. So that's yet another way that I was able to collect and get the story that I am going to tell today.
Great. Could you tell us a little bit about how you came to receive this story?
Well, I had written all kinds of storytellers that I could find on the internet and through connections of other people, saying that I would be traveling through, definitely through the United Kingdom, because that was a place where I could get the story without having to have a translator. And one of the people that I connected with said, oh, you have to meet Stanley Robertson. Mm. And Stanley Robertson was an elder at the time. And he agreed to meet with us. He was just a delightful man. He's a traveler. And before I started to learn about stories across the United Kingdom, I didn't know what travelers were. Someone had described them to me as gypsies, but they're not related to the Rom. They are the roaming people that traveled through the United Kingdom. And in some of the stories that I tell, they're often the people that have like what they call a caravan. You know, it's like a wagon pulled by horses, and they were known as really good horsemen, and also people that would come and fix your pots and pans. You know, they'd mend them. But also people were wary of them. And so when I met Stanley, he told me that when he was a boy, it was legal to hang a man for just being a traveler. And he also told me that he was a minister of his faith, because we talked about all of his travels that he had done as a Mormon minister. And he said, you know, I could have gone to just about any church at the time, but the Mormons were the only ones that would allow the travelers to join. Wow. He said, so it must have been the place for me to be.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's stunning. So they traveled all through Britain then?
Yeah, all through England, Ireland, Scotland. This particular gentleman was in Scotland. In fact, he met me at the university in Aberdeen, and he was very proud to be able to meet me in his office that they had given him, because he had spent so much time with the professors there. recording old stories from Scotland that would have been lost because the oral tradition, a lot of the elders were dying. And so they even gave him his own office. They gave him an honorary degree. And then he gave me a tour of the campus because he said when he was a boy, this was my Camelot, he said. He said, see these buildings and see how they look like a castle on the top of them? He said, this is what I used to pretend that I was in my own Camelot. And I remember he led me to this little hidden space that was between buildings. You would have never found it because there were high bushes around it, but it was actually an old graveyard. And we were looking at it and you could barely read the stones. They were so worn away. But as we were leaving, I found this little tiny bone. And I picked it up and I said, oh, look at this. It's a bone. And started to put it in my pocket. And he said, well, I don't know if I would do that if I were you. He said, you never know who may follow you home.
Oh, goodness. Wow. So he ended up there. That's wonderful. His Camelot.
Yeah. It's a dear man. And he only died a few years ago.
I think I may have read a story on the air that he collected and maybe was in one of his books. It was a Selkie tale. Did he do
that? Oh, that might have been Duncan Williams.
Oh, no, you're right. You're right.
Who's okay. Also a traveler, and he was part Irish. So some of his stories came from Ireland. Some came from Scotland. Both of them. I was fortunate enough to be able to meet with them both.
Wow.
Maybe another time I'll bring you a Duncan Williams
story. Oh, I'd love to hear it. Yeah, definitely. Well, but let's hear a Stanley Robinson collected tale.
Okay. Well, this is the story that Stanley told me sitting in his office in the university at Aberdeen, where he was very proud to have his own chair and his own desk. There once was an elder gentleman who lived in a wee stone cottage up on the mountain above the tree line around the Rocky Burren. And though he was getting up in years, he was still able to take care of himself, to haul his wood and to cut it and to do his own cooking and his own housekeeping. And if you were to ask him about his life, he would say, well, I'm content enough. You know, I don't really have much to complain of, and I have many a good memory to look back on. And so it was that he was up there on the mountain on Christmas Eve when his granddaughter came to visit him. And his granddaughter, after visiting for a while, said, oh, grandfather, won't you come back down the mountain with me and spend Christmas Eve and Christmas with the family? We don't hardly see you enough, and mother gets worried about you. I mean, she says there's a storm coming in, and won't you please come down and spend it with us? And the grandfather took the lassie's hand, and he patted it, and he said, oh, my dear, you tell your mother that I am just content and fine here. I have everything you need. And look what you brought me. You brought me some fine bread and a dollop of butter and some jam. That will keep me just fine. He said, now tell her not to worry and to be honest with you. This time of the year, when the nights are long and dark, well, it seems to me that the veil between this world and the other world thin. And I swear to you, lassie, that there's many a night when I can see my dear departed Bridget, you know, your grandmother that died. I see her standing here by me, and I can almost hear her talking to me. So you go on down the mountain. You have a wonderful Christmas. Give your mother and everyone a hug from me and tell them not to worry. Well, it took a bit of convincing, but finally the lassie headed on down the mountain. But who should she come across as she's going down the mountain but this man? I mean, he was elder. In fact, he was even older than her grandfather, and thin. And he wore a long robe with long sleeves and a hood pulled up over his head, so it was hard to see his face, except she could see a long gray beard coming out. And she noticed that in one hand he held an hourglass, and in the other hand he had it wrapped around a handle, and sure enough, down his back she could see the glint off of a scythe. And then she knew it was Death himself. Well, she looked down and she curtsied and she said, pleased to meet you, sir. Hope you're having a good day. And he said, good day to you, lassie. Can I ask, sir, where might you be going on Christmas Eve up the mountain? There's a storm coming in. Ah, well, thanks for the warning, lassie. I have an appointment up on the mountain this very evening. Well, she stood there and watched as he went around the corner and up the left on the other path, and then she ran up the path on the right all the way back to her grandfather's and pounded on the door and said, "Grandfather, grandfather, you have to come with me. You have to come down to the village tonight, because who do you think I just met but Death himself? And he said he has an appointment on the mountain. Oh, grandfather, please come with me. Maybe then you could avoid him." Well, the old man, he just gave her a hug and said, "You know as well as I that if Death is coming for me, there's no place I can hide or outrun him. And really, lassie, I just got everything ready, put in the stew pot, and put it over the fire for my dinner. And if it's going to be my last dinner, you know, I might as well just stay here and enjoy it. Now, don't you worry. I've had a fine life, and I'm content as I am. You go on down, and you have a wonderful Christmas." Well, I'll tell you, it was with a hard heart that the lassie left and went on down. And he went back, the old man, and he stoked up the fire and stirred the stew in the pot. And sure enough, not long after that, the wind started to blow and whistle around the rocks in his house. And then the sleet started to come down, and followed by the snow. And it wasn't too long after that that he heard a knocking at the door. And so he went and opened it, and sure enough, there stood Death in the long robes with the hourglass in one hand and the scythe in the other. He said, "Come in, come in. I've been expecting you. Come and warm yourself by the fire." "Oh," said Death, I could use a bit of warmth. There's fierce weather out there." "Yes, go on, stand by the fire. That's fine." And so Death leaned his scythe up against the rocks around the mantle of the fire. And then the old man said, "You know, I was just about to have some mutton stew. And there's plenty for both of us. That is, if you have the time." "Well, you know, I think I could use a bit of something to eat. I'm a bit hungry. Yes, yes, that would be fine." Well, no sooner had the old man dished out the stew then he remembered that he had been keeping a fine bottle of whiskey in the bottom of the back closet for a special occasion, and he thought, why let it go to waste? And so he brought it out, and he said to Death, "Would you like a wee dram to go with your dinner?" "Well, I do think I would. Yes, that would warm me further still." And so, wouldn't you know, the two of them were eating and drinking down that whole bottle of whiskey. And so, sure enough, they started swapping stories back and forth. Until finally, Death, he picked up the hourglass and he looked at it and he said, "Well, this has been a fine time, and I do thank you, but I think it's time that I go now." "Oh, okay," said the old man. And so they both pushed back their chairs, and Death started to head towards the door, and the old man got his coat on and followed him. And Death turned and said, "Wait, where are you going?" He goes, "Well, you said it was time to go." "Oh, no, 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 not you, my friend. I just knew that you were the type of person that would be kind enough to let me come in and warm myself by your fire. And look what you did. You gave me some whiskey to drink, and you gave me mutton stew and fine conversation to boot. No, 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 no. I have an appointment farther up the mountain with an old woman. She's been crippled up with arthritis for years, and she's been in pain, and I tell you, she'll be happy to see me. But because you've been so kind, let me tell you, good man, you have many more years in your life left to go. And I will tell you this, when I do come for you, you'll know me for the friend that I am." And so, what Death told him was right. That man lived for a good many more years and had many more visits with his family and his granddaughter, and many more mutton stews and bottles of whiskey to share with a friend. But when Death did come for him, well, he was content, and he knew him for the friend that he was.
Oh, thank you, Allison. What a beautiful story. What I love about that one is just the way the grandfather was just embracing life and living it fully and enjoying every bit of it, and the stew and the warmth, and then inviting Death in and just accepting, and then Death himself, the character of Death in this one, is he's, wow, it's a kind soul. What a And this is, you know, I would definitely say this is like a healing story for sure. For all of us who might be not really looking forward to that kind of meeting. There's probably so much we can say about that story. What do you love about that story?
Well, one of the things that comes to mind is the practice of hospitality. Mm-hmm. And the fact that if anybody had come, you know, when my great grandparents that my great grandmother had come from Ireland, and anybody that wanted to spend the weekend with our family when they all got together and played poker, and all the men would try to compete with who would cook the better recipe and keep their recipe secret. It was really funny because the women would be laughing at them, that they'd all be joking about, no, I can't tell you what's in my chili. Is that anybody that wanted to come was welcomed. You know, if you had a friend that was alone that night, you just brought him with. And the kids would be running under the feet, and we'd be playing the player piano. And that's, you know, the tradition that they came from. That's our roots. I'm Welsh and Irish, and my sister married a man from Scotland, from Paisley. And so I find that. And I think I miss a bit of that, too, that. And so that just gives you also an idea that the way that in this particular story, and I think several of the stories that I found specifically from Scotland, is that death is got human qualities. It's not a specter. It's not an evil monster. It's a he, mm-hmm. often, although some cultures say that death is a she. And he can come in and sit by the fire and be cold and want and hungry and get warm by whiskey. And I love that they were swapping stories too.
Yeah. Yeah.
You kind of can't help it.
Right. It's in the culture, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. As is awake.
Right.
You know? I think we were talking at the at your storytelling at the library about when I went to my grandmother's wake, wondering how I was going to cope with it, until she started to narrate in my ear, in my mind, saying, oh my God, look at the dress that they put me in the coffin. I can't believe they picked that store, you know, that color. And get your uncle away from the punch before he gets drunk and makes a mess of things. And so, yeah, it's just, you know, everything is, it's another day in the life, even death.
Right, yeah. And you bring to mind that part of the whole Celtic sensibility too is this, the thinness of the world. It's a sense that we really can be having a conversation with our loved one, and also the saints, and you know, Mary can come by, and Joseph, and you can, you know, invite them in and have something for them as well. And
that's right. They say that Bridget, who was, you know, originally one of the major goddesses of Ireland, and later she became a saint. Because I guess they figured they had to bring her in there, or they weren't going to mm-hmm. come along with the Catholic Church. She was also talked about as being Mary's midwife.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to try to think from the United States, you know, in my own sensibility, how did they wrap their head around that? But for them, there was no issue.
That's right.
You know, I mean, of course Bridget could do that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because she's Bridget.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, we could experience a lot of the world if we kind of lean into that Celtic knowing, if we have that in our DNA, or if we don't. I'm sure we have it in whatever of our genetics is knew that really we're closer. We're all a lot closer than we tend to think in this culture. So Allison, you are very much involved in storytelling and in the Seattle Storytellers Guild, Storytelling Guild,
mm-hmm.
and you have a. And in fact, you're putting together an event that's taking place in March. I wonder if you could talk about that.
Yeah, in March. In fact, Jane, you're going to be part of it. Mm-hmm. We are going to join forces with the Nordic Heritage Museum, because it turns out, and I was surprised to learn this, that it's the Finn Centennial this year. And the Finns, even though Finland's been around for a long time as a nation, they have only been officially recognized for the last 100 years. I think they got run over by Sweden and Russia there for a bit. But when this story was collected, and I don't know if I'm going to do his name justice, Elias Lönnrot, he was sort of like a local physician that would travel out into the countryside and see if people needed some help. And he started collecting the stories. The stories were sung at that time, and they were all in verse, and there would be two people holding hands, and one would swing forward and say the first line, and then he'd swing back, and the other would sing the second line. And I, as a storyteller, imagining having to learn verse and switch every other line, am so amazed. And so he collected these, and he was able to put them in an order and fill in a little of the gaps, and he published it as the Kalevala. And that is one of the forces that got Finland to have more a stronger identity as a country and as a language and move them towards their independence. So every year, the Nordic Heritage Museum has a Kalevala festival on one day. But this day, because we're because it's the centennial, we're going to add a second day on. So on the March 25th Saturday, the storytellers, 17 storytellers from California, Oregon, Washington, and Canada, all are donating their time and money. They're paying for their way to get here because this is so important to them, are coming together to tell the whole Kalevala epic from noon until 6. And we have harpists like you, Jane, and we have some kantele players, which part of the Kalevala story is to talk about how Väinämöinen, the oldest man, created the kantele. And I think it's going to be fabulous. I mean, where else, I don't know where else you can see in one afternoon that many storytellers from that many places that are of such high quality.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. It's pretty exciting to me.
Thank you. And then the next day at the museum, they will have their festival too, so people can come and see dancing and singing. And hopefully both days they'll have some sati, which is a type of liquor that they brew and ferment inside a hollowed out log.
Wow.
I know. So I want to taste that stuff.
That sounds intriguing. That's fantastic. So let's see. You recently did a house concert on Animal Stories.
I did. Up in Edmonds, I did a whole concert on some of my favorite animal stories. And I was able to share the one story about the elephants at Tula Tula on Friday. Actually, two, because I also told the story about the geese.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. So, and another favorite subject of mine, to have people be aware of the environment and of how animals think more than we know.
Yeah. Yeah. They were really, the elephant story was, I think, the favorite of the evening. Everybody was really deeply moved by entering into the emotions of the elephants and their responses. So sometime we'll have to, I don't know, do an animal show here. And even though,
well, there's plenty of Celtic animal stories. Yeah. Too.
So we'll have Allison again for sure. Do you have any house concerts that are coming up in the Puget Sound area? Or?
Well, you know, the next concert that I'm taking part on is on Whidbey Island, and that's on St. Patrick's Day.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And I wish that I'd remembered to bring the place, but I'm listed in the phone book, Allison Cox. If anybody thinks they're going to be up there, they can give me a call and I'll tell them where to find us. It's going to be myself and Jill Johnson and Catherine Guy Peroni, and Catherine's going to be singing and playing the fiddle and the guitar and the penny whistle, and all three of us are bringing our favorite Celtic stories from all across the UK.
That sounds really, really fun. Where can people find you? On the internet or elsewhere?
They can find me. I'm on Facebook under my name, Allison Cox, and they can also go to dancingleaves.com/Allison, A-L-L-I-S-O-N, and that's my website.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Allison, and for telling stories, the Scottish story, and also the stories around the stories.
It never ends.
Yeah. So we'll definitely have you back again.
Thanks.
Great.
You are listening to a show that was originally broadcast on March 5th, 2017. All mention of events in the show are from that time, 2017.
We're going to go ahead and listen to some Kim Robertson playing Turlough O'Carolan's piece, Separation of Soul and Body, and two versions of it, actually. It's going to be followed by another Turlough O'Carolan piece, the clergy's lamentation with, you'll hear separation of soul and body in a vocal that comes, weaves in through that. So enjoy that. Thank you. Kim Robertson with The Clergy's Lamentation and Separation of Soul and Body by Turlough O'Carolan, the harper from the 17th century. So you are listening to Forest Halls Celtic on Voice of Vashon, voiceofvashon.org and KVSH 101.9 FM. We're going to go to the shores of Avalon with Oregon musician, singer-songwriter Tina Malia. This piece has Arthurian themes. You'll hear, you know, in Arthurian legend that after the last battle, Arthur was mortally wounded, and then he was placed in a boat and was sailed over to Avalon, where he would be tended to by Morgan Le Fay and others of Avalon. And really, Avalon is the other world, and it is a place of the Isle of the Dead. And in the case of King Arthur, he's awaiting his rebirth when his land needs him again. But basically, he's out there in the other world or beyond at this point. So beyond Avalon, there are many flavors of other world, Celtic other world. So Tina Malia.
Cross the Tintagel Sea. The fragrant air, the apple blossoms have all been beckoning. And there we'll stand, looking out upon left to see.
Tina Malia with Shores of Avalon. You have been listening to Forest Halls Celtic. This show airs live on first and third Sundays from 12 to 1 p.m. Sorry, I'm thinking of something else here. And it with rebroadcasts on the second and fourth Sundays at the same time. You can catch the latest episode on demand at voiceofvashon.org. And just go to the shows and hosts tab and click on Forest Halls Celtic, and you'll find the latest show there. I want to thank you all for joining me today and being on the show and with the show, and especially to Allison Cox for being on the show and telling her wonderful story and sharing the stories around the story. And I want to thank my husband, Andy Valencia, for helping me behind the scenes with the technical aspects of the show. So thank you very much, and I hope to find you here again in Forest Halls Celtic.